From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The new film Obvious Child is about a 27-year-old stand-up comic who becomes pregnant after sleeping with a guy she just met.
We wanted to make a romantic comedy with a strong, empowered, funny female lead who has a safe, regrets-free, shame-free abortion.
Today we talk with the film's writer and director, Gillian Robespierre, and the film's star, Jenny Slate, who Robespierre cast after seeing her stand-up act.
I saw the range in the 10 minutes that Jenny was performing, and a couple days later we were in my apartment drinking beers and smoking cigarettes out the window.
Maybe. Depending on whose mom's listening.
Also, Ken Tucker reviews the new album Ultraviolence from controversy-prone pop star Lana Del Rey. And Maureen Corrigan reviews a new book about how James Joyce's masterpiece Ulysses came to be published and banned. First news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new romantic comedy, Obvious Child, stars my guest Jenny Slate as a 27-year-old stand-up comic who still doesn't quite think of herself as an adult. After getting drunk and sleeping with a guy she just met, she finds out she's pregnant and decides to have an abortion. Not your typical rom-com plot twist. The movie was written and directed by Gillian Robespierre, who is also with us. It's her first feature-length film. Jenny Slate is a stand-up comic as well as an actress. She's a former cast member of Saturday Night Live. She has recurring roles on Comedy Central's Kroll Show, NBC's Parks and Recreation, Fox's Bob's Burgers, and the new FX series Married. She voiced the animated shorts Marcel the Shell with Shoes On, which she co-wrote with her husband and adapted into a best-selling children's book. Let's start with a scene from early on in Obvious Child. Slate's character, Donna, does stand-up at a bar in Brooklyn at night, but she's just found out that her day job is about to end. The bookstore where she's worked for the past 5 years is closing. To make matters worse, her boyfriend just dumped her. After this double dose of bad news, she visits her mother, a university professor, played by Polly Draper. They talk over dinner.
You know, an ex-student of mine started a temp agency? They specialize in placing people in the entertainment world.
Are you past the duck sauce?
You're about to lose your income. You don't seem the least bit concerned.
I'm terrified, Mom. Believe me, I very much am, but I'm not going to work for one of your business school students.
You're almost 30 years old. You still don't know how to do your taxes.
I'm a couple of years away from 30, and nobody knows how to do their taxes.
Have you spoken to your agent about booking any commercial work?
You know, I haven't, because recently she put her entire body into her oven.
Oh, you're never serious.
I will use TurboTax this year, okay?
Hand me the plate.
Well, I don't know if you've noticed, but I'm in kind of an emotional crisis right now.
I know you're going through some pain right now, but you're always going to be going through something.
I haven't borrowed money from you in months, and I just did that commercial for the organic douche, which is going to be a real boon to my image.
Well, I'm glad you did the douche job. The douche paid well.
Definitely stop saying douche.
There are other things in your life you could afford to be a little more selective about. Your next beau, for example. I'll never forget that brunch when he told us his SAT scores.
Mom, really? A lot of people aren't good test takers.
You were. And now you waste that 780 verbal on telling jokes about having diarrhea in your pants.
That's a scene from Obvious Child. Gillian Robespierre, Jenny Slate, welcome to Fresh Air.
Hi, thank you.
Thank you, Terry. Thanks for having us.
Why did you want to make abortion a central part of this character's story?
Well, you know, this started as a short film in 2009 that I created with my friends Anna Bean and Karen Main, and it starred Jenny. And we really just wanted to combine a lot of things that we felt our culture was suppressing. One is a strong, empowered, funny female lead. And one idea that I feel like has been sort of swept under the carpet is a realistic abortion that is done safely and with a lot of thought put into it and, you know, has a happy ending in the end.
And Jenny, you were obviously comfortable with all of this. No.
Yeah. Oh, certainly. I was excited by it. I think it's important for us to say that this is just one woman's experience, and we're not saying, you know, like, if you get pregnant at 27, you must have an abortion, and this is how it's got to go down. You know, there are a lot of films and where the woman has the baby and deals with it in her own way. I don't think of the abortion that Donna decides to get as part of her personality or like the most important thing that has ever happened to her. I think it turns out being a clear, thoughtful choice that she makes, you know, in her adulthood. But in general, I was really excited because the character is at once really gentle and very bold and sweet, but also can be rather body at times. And so I was just very excited and invigorated by what seemed to me to be a modern story.
The character that is at the center of the movie, Donna, is at a transitional point in her life. She's 27, but she doesn't yet think of herself as like a real adult. She's a comic, but she doesn't yet know if she'll really get much further than the kind of bar that she performs in. She wants to be in a relationship, but her boyfriend's just dumped her. How close does that part of your life seem to you, where you felt like you were in this transitional phase, not a kid anymore, but not fully an adult in a fully formed adult life yet?
You know, that used to be a big part of my own stand-up. And I was just recently saying, I don't say things like that in my stand-up anymore. I used to talk a lot about, I sort of say the same things over and over again, or explore the same areas, my childhood and my formative years and my sexuality. But it used to be in my 20s, and especially my early 20s, feeling like an imposter adult. I think I really felt that way when I had graduated from college, especially coming from basically like an incredibly structured lifestyle and environment for my entire life, and then being just spit out into New York and really scared. But yeah, I don't think I feel that way anymore. But I definitely relate to Donna's experience there, for sure. And it's not an easy one.
And you're what, 32
yeah.
now?
I'm 32, yeah.
I'm 35, and I don't think by any means I've learned everything I'm supposed to have learned yet. And I'm constantly growing, but there's something that happened when I hit the 30s where my confidence changed and my voice changed, because I wasn't scared anymore about where I was supposed to be, who I was supposed to be. And it wasn't like the day my birthday hit and then it all snapped into place. It was just like this subtle growth spurt that happened from 30 to 35 that sort of formed my own opinions of myself and sort of blocking out the outside voices. And I don't think Donna has done that yet. And she does it in the movie, where she starts off, you know, kind of meek, and we slowly watch her become more active and less passive in her life in the 83 minutes.
Gillian, when you say your voice changed when you were in your 30s, do you mean like your writer's voice or literally your voice?
My testicles dropped.
Right.
And I think that it was both. It's not just the voice on the page, even though, you know, we started this movie and I was in my 20s. I was Donna's age. And so it definitely was a combination of my writing voice, but also my voice not as a creator. It was being at a job that, you know, I went to every day. And for 7 years, I was very mature about showing up to work on time and doing my work, and then working on this movie in nights and weekends. And I think that the 25-year-old me would have sort of shunned that and thought that was not cool, that I should just, you know, be writing all the time.
Gillian, did you write the part of Donna for Jenny?
Oh, yes.
You were already friends?
We met in 2009 while we were making the short. My collaborators, Karen Main and Anna Bean, and I were looking to cast the role of Donna, and we had not found her yet. So we did what any like 25-year-old would do on a Wednesday night, which is go see free comedy. And there Jenny was on stage. She was co-hosting this show called Big Terrific, which was in the back of a record store in Williamsburg. And she was co-hosting an evening with Gabe Liebman and Max Silvestri.
And Gabe Liebman's in your movie.
And Gabe pops up 5 years later in Obvious Child, the feature. And she was just articulating everything that we were thinking in our heads and have been talking about, you know, around our kitchen table or at bars about our bodies. And like I, you know, we all looked at each other and we just had to ask Jenny to be in our movie, because Donna had the same sort of voice. And we needed somebody who had dramatic range and also comic timing. And up there in her confessional style storytelling comedy, I saw the range in the 10 minutes that Jenny was performing. So we had a friend in common, sent her the script. A couple days later, we were in my apartment drinking beers and smoking cigarettes out the window.
Maybe. Depending on whose mom's listening.
And when I sat down to write the feature, it was 100% for Jenny.
My guests are Gillian Robespierre, the writer and director of Obvious Child, and Jenny Slate, the film's star. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Gillian Robespierre, the writer and director of the new romantic comedy Obvious Child, and Jenny Slate, the star of the film. Slate plays Donna, a 27-year-old stand-up comic whose career hasn't gone any further than the bar in Brooklyn where she performs her confessional monologues. After spending the night with a guy she just met, she discovers she's pregnant and decides to have an abortion. In this scene, she's performing at the bar. You'll hear her stumble a bit when she sees the guy she slept with walk into the room.
You guys like my singing voice? I just burped into this because I'm an adult woman. I do like being an adult woman. I've always wanted to be that. I've always wanted to have just like a bra and a blouse. And a schedule, like, where I could just, like, be in my house and just be like, oh, my God, I'm running late, you know? Like, always wanted to be able to be on the car phone and be like, okay, Susan, will do. What? Okay. All right. Talk soon. And then just hang up and not worry about, you know, like, why the bathroom smells in a weird way. But I'm not here to talk about car phones. I came here tonight on a very different mission, and that is to say to you that, that I am pregnant. Ooh. Ooh, okay, all right. Testing the waters, I dropped that one down. The second thing that I would like to say right now out loud, and I'm going to say it out loud right now. I'm fine. Everything's fine. Just rolling along with this out loud right now, is that I am going to have an abortion. Okay. Keep breathing. Tomorrow, which is Valentine's Day. So we'll start from there.
Like the character Jenny Slate portrays, Slate does stand-up comedy that is frank and autobiographical. Slate has done a lot of comedy about sexuality and body issues. Gillian Robespierre wrote the part of Donna for Slate after hearing a performance in which Slate talked about discovering sexual feelings as a child. We talked about that in the interview. That part was really funny, but it was also a little too explicit for broadcast. We will have it for you as an extra online. I'll tell you where to find it at the end of the interview. This next part of our conversation refers to the section we couldn't broadcast in which Slate discussed doing stand-up comedy about her early sexual feelings. That really takes, I think, guts to stand on stage and talk about that, especially when people don't know who you are yet. And maybe right. It's easier when people don't know who you are, but it's not like you already have a reputation you can fall back on. And I think until recently, people were really not used to hearing that kind of discussion from women comics on stage. Men, you know, there's a long history of men talking about sexual things on stage.
Yeah, well, you know, this is the way that I speak to my friends. And I always notice that I felt this sort of zing of excitement and connection with people, and I felt my identity kind of shining when I would speak about my family and growing up, because it did shape who I am as a woman, and it's my way of introducing myself and of sort of laying out all of my imperfections and the little doodads that hang off of my personality that I want to protect, but I'm also maybe a little bit unsure of if they'll be accepted. So I think socially I knew that it worked for me. And then when I graduated from college, Gabe Liedman and I started to be a stand-up duo, and we got on stage together. So that was wonderful for me because we really talked about each other. So first it was him and I discussing me, and then we would discuss him. And so it started that way, and I could tell that it worked. And I don't know. I never was scared. I was more scared of not being able to perform. Mm-hmm. And I think I learned a lot about myself when I started doing stand-up and grew through my 20s. But I just felt like I was working from my nature, and it felt really good. And I was in the alternative comedy scene. I wasn't like in clubs and stuff. So that also helped.
In the very opening minute of the movie, when your character is on stage, she's telling jokes about her vagina and her underwear. Gillian, why did you want to start the movie there? Just like start it right there.
Yeah. Well, we always knew we wanted to start on Donna's comedy. And in the editing room, we sort of crafted together different options for which joke she could start on. And we finally landed Casey Brooks, myself, and my producer, Elizabeth Holm, had many, many discussions about it. And we just went for it because we wanted to set the tone. And Donna's tone was somebody who's unapologetically herself on and off stage. And it just felt like a strong joke to start on. Instead of inching towards it, we wanted to just put it as the rollout, the first one. And I'm really glad we did that, because I think it's like there's no time getting to know Donna. We know Donna after 30 seconds.
Now, you're younger than I am. When I was growing up, the word vagina was just like a scary word, like it's a word that you didn't say, you know? And that's changed a lot, I'm glad to say. Did you grow up with any of that, like, you don't say that word? That's a scary word. You don't talk about it, you don't say it?
Not at all. My mom said vagina all the time. She drew me a diagram of, you know, my lady parts, and I believe she laminated it after, because everything was laminated in our house. My bus pass, I grew up in the city, so she would laminate my bus passes, and she would laminate my diagrams of, you know, like, this is your ovaries, this is your uterus, and they're your fallopian tubes. I wish I saved it. But vagina was nothing shameful in my house. And I do remember one conversation where, when I was little, I would only just wear a T-shirt and around the house, you know, and my underwear, obviously. But there was that conversation as a little girl at a certain point. I think maybe it was like fourth grade or fifth grade, where it's like, Gilly, you have to wear shorts now. Mm. Because I would just sit Indian style, vagina out, right, watching TV. And that conversation, I think, scared me, because that's when I realized that I was growing up, and I don't think I was ready to understand that meant wearing shorts and pants around my house.
So while we're talking about bodies, another thing about the comedy in the movie, and the movie we're talking about, by the way, if you're just joining us, is Obvious Child, and my guests are the writer and director of the film, Gillian Robespierre, and the star of the film, Jenny Slate, who plays a comic. So part of the comedy, Jenny, that your character does in the movie has to do with farting. And again, a long history of men who've done jokes about that. Not so much women. And I think, you know, that's one of those odd places where there's really been like a double standard, where like men joke about it all the time and, you know, perform it even, you know, do it in a performative way. But for a woman, I think it's just considered this like horrible embarrassment. So, Jenny, have you talked about that in your own stand-up? And then, Gillian, I'll ask you about, you know, writing it into the movie.
Yeah, certainly I do talk about my stomach and, you know, all of the different problems that it has. And I think I'm particularly good at making fart noises, and I can do a lot of different ones. And actually, I'm on a cartoon on Fox called Bob's Burgers, and they let me make my own fart noises for that character. That's just a point of pride.
Great.
But yeah, thank you. Thank you so much. dream come true right now to be able to say that. You know, I always thought that farts were funny, and I always thought that they were mine to talk about because they came out of my body, or I heard them in life coming out of other people's bodies. So they're part of my experience. And my grandmother used to say, I don't like that word, fat. Mm-hmm. She didn't want us to, I was told not, you know, she didn't want us to say it at Shabbat and stuff. But I never thought of it as something that a woman or a girl wouldn't talk about. And I think I was aware when I started doing stand-up, especially on my own, that, yeah, I'm getting up on stage and I'm a woman and I dress in sort of a typically feminine fashion. You know, I like to wear dresses and skirts, and the attitude that I have is I'm so excited to introduce myself to you. and I want to be wearing what I would wear to a date or a dinner party. And I guess when I'm up there, maybe I'm imagining a world where my nature is celebrated and my gender is just part of it. And, you know, I talk about farts. It never seemed like a big thing.
Gillian, yeah, you want to talk about
farts? Farts are funny.
Yeah.
I feel like when I finally saw Jenny on stage in 2009, I was really excited. She was talking about her body in a way that didn't seem too far off about, you know, from how I spoke. I just don't go on stage, and I'm not a stand-up. But she was speaking exactly how I feel like every woman in the audience speaks to their friends. And I have always been sort of obsessed with scatological humor, with my digestive tract or tracts. And I think that farts are funny, and I think talking about it is not raunchy. I think it's actually quite confessional and vulnerable, and makes you a little empathetic too. So I think there's a combination when you talk about what goes in and out of your body that makes it not just really laugh out loud funny, but also something that other people can connect to you with.
Gillian Robespierre and Jenny Slate will talk more about their new romantic comedy, Obvious Child, in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from Viking River Cruises, exploring the world in comfort, offering European cruises on Viking longships. More at vrc.com/radio. From Lumosity.com, personalized brain training developed by neuroscientists to challenge memory and problem solving through games. Lumosity.com. This is NPR.
They say I'm too young to love you.
Coming up, Ken Tucker reviews Lana Del Rey's new album, Ultraviolence. Also, Maureen Corrigan reviews a new book about how James Joyce's masterpiece, Ulysses, came to be published and banned. And we continue our conversation with Gillian Robespierre, the director and writer of the new film Obvious Child, and Jenny Slate, the film's star.
I'm churning out novels like beat poetry on amphetamines. I say, I say, well, my
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Gillian Robespierre, the director of the new romantic comedy Obvious Child, and Jenny Slate, the film's star. Slate plays a stand-up comic who does autobiographical, very personal material in her act. Robespierre wrote the part for Slate. Slate is a comic as well as an actress. She's a former Saturday Night Live cast member and has recurring roles in Parks and Recreation, Kroll Show, Bob's Burgers, and the new FX series Married. So another thing about the comedy in the movie Obvious Child, there's you know, at least one scene where Jenny, your character, is doing stand-up, and the character stand-up is very autobiographical, and the person that she's talking about is in the audience. Like at the beginning of the movie, she's talking about her boyfriend who's in the club and is listening to what she's saying. You've probably experienced that, since your comedy is autobiographical, that you're talking about somebody who's there. Has that ever come back to haunt you, that you've said something that you thought was funny, but actually maybe ended up hurting the feelings of the person you were talking about?
I think I'm pretty careful, actually. I just recently went on the Jimmy Kimmel show, and, you know, I have a lot of stand-up about my dad and that he slept in a nightgown for a lot of my childhood, which is really funny and adorable. And I called him before, and I was like, you know, Dad, I'm thinking about talking about this. Is that okay? And he said, oh, yeah, you know, you need to do whatever you want to do. But my parents have only seen me do stand-up like 2 times, and both times they were there, I did not speak about them because I didn't want to hurt their feelings or make them feel targeted. I think I'm really careful to make sure not to hurt people's feelings. I don't talk about my husband in a way that would ever embarrass him. I'm very aware of those boundaries, whereas Donna isn't. But sometimes I think that I'm very aware of them because I am a middle child and I am very talkative and gregarious. And sometimes I walk away from, a lot of times I walk away from situations and say, like, man, I just talked for that entire time. And it was because I was excited, but I didn't let anybody else talk. And that really embarrasses me. And so I think when I'm on stage, I am aware of, okay, you're asking all these people to look at you and you love it. And they know that you love it and you need it. So make sure that you're giving them something useful and that it's not masturbatory, even if you're talking about masturbation. And I think I'm just really aware of those boundaries. I would never want to hurt anyone's feelings, including my own.
So, Jenny, I have a couple of questions for you about your career as a performer. A lot of our listeners will remember you from your brief stay on Saturday Night Live. Mm-hmm. You were there for one season. And this is a kind of famous story, like your first night on Saturday Night Live. You're doing a sketch, and you accidentally say an expletive. An expletive,
yes.
That there was supposed to be like the clean version of. Like, what was the word you were allowed to say on the air?
I was supposed to say frickin', and I said something else.
Right. How did you end up? Like, can you take us through what happened? Is it too painful to ask you to do that?
No. In fact, it's not painful at all. It's if I can be honest, I've just talked about it so much,
mm-hmm.
And the only thing that I feel, you know, that like kind of tugs at me is just that I don't want the people that I really like and respect from Saturday Night Live to think that 4 years later, when I'm like, you know, on 4 TV shows and have this movie coming out and I'm a New York Times bestselling author, that I'm talking about this because somehow I think it's like the most important thing about myself. Like, but I do understand why people ask, and I don't mean to be disrespectful at all. I just, you know, that's my honest feeling about it, and I would at least like to say that before I, but I don't mind talking about it. I just think I've never said that before part until recently about why I would hope, you know, that soon I can stop talking about it. But hopefully our movie will be successful enough that people will say, like, oh, you're the girl from the, that thing. But anyway.
The abortion rom-com.
But, yeah, it was my childhood dream to be on Saturday Night Live and to be a movie actress. It was really weird for me to make such a giant mistake on my first episode. And in general, I've been, like, you know, really good in school and don't like to make a lot of mistakes, and was just, like, terrified that happened, and was really embarrassing. And I felt like I really let myself down, and I didn't like it in that moment. But everyone was very nice to me, and I think the Saturday Night Live that I wanted to be on was maybe the one from like the 70s or something. I don't think I was well suited for the show. I don't know. I think socially everybody was nice, but I think I'm happier out of it, being free and being able to do many different things and being able to take risks.
What was the first door that opened for you after Saturday Night Live?
Well, really, what happened was that my husband and I created Marcel the Shell with Shoes On. My husband's name is Dean Fleischer Camp, and he created the little character of Marcel, who's a shell who has one eye and 2 shoes, and he has a little voice that he talks in, sounds like this. And we made this YouTube thing. It wasn't meant to be on YouTube. It was just for our friend's art show, but we put it on, and it got millions and millions of views. I think we're at, like, 22 million now. So that was the first thing that happened, was that even though I was fired, and I was embarrassed by that, and I think, you know, I got fired like by reading it on like Deadline Hollywood, which was just like high school, you know, just like, oh my God, you're embarrassed. Like, boom, you're just there. But the resounding response to Marcel was, we like this. And it seemed like a lot of people online liked my creative efforts, and it helped me get back up and feel that there's many ways that I can be creative. So there was that. And then really the most important thing that happened to me that year creatively was that my friend Nick Kroll, who has a show called The Kroll Show, which is on Comedy Central, asked me to be in his pilot. And that was really huge for me because, you know, he's one of the funniest people I've ever met. I didn't actually know him that well at the time, and had a fear of being shunned maybe by other comedians because I had gotten fired, which never happened. And no, that was just coming from me, you know. In fact, most of the negative things that I experienced came from my own being hard on myself, which is, you know, you can only learn from that type of self-abuse. But he asked me to be on the show, and it brought my confidence back to be included, especially with somebody who I respect so much. So that was a huge turning point for me, just personally, having someone say, I have a thing with my name on it. I would like you to be in it. You're not embarrassing.
So I read, Jenny, that there was a period when you developed stage fright and you went to a hypnotist.
Yeah, I did.
How did you suddenly develop stage fright? I would have assumed that it was something that you either had or didn't, as opposed to getting it after not having it.
I know. I never thought I would get stage fright. I love talking and I love performing. I am hungry for it all the time. But I think I got it after SNL for the exact reason, you know, when you said it must be hard to get up without a reputation that you can fall back on. I actually experienced the opposite of that, which is it's usually nice to get up there as a stranger. I realized that I didn't like getting up there as somebody whose thing that most people maybe knew was that I said a swear, you know, that, and honestly, I don't even care about that. Like, I just felt, you know, like it was kind of high school-y, and I felt irritated and mad, and I felt like all this stuff is being put on me because I'm the girl that said this swear. And in a way, Donna goes through that too. She's like, all this stuff is happening to me. I'm dumped. I'm fired, you know, so I really get that. And I got up on stage thinking that maybe people wouldn't like me to be there. And that just broke my heart and made me act weird. And I got terrible stage fright. I just couldn't remember how to speak to people anymore. I would have a list. You know, I never write my stand-up out. It's just bullet points. And the bullet points were like, they were just boring. There was nothing. And my husband always told me, like, you're not bombing. It's fine. You're just not enjoying yourself. And you're not trusting anybody. And that's what the sad thing is that you're not trusting yourself or anyone else. And he said that it made him really sad to see me. I tried to just stop. You know, I just was like, I'm not going to do this anymore. I can't handle it. And my husband was like, you can cut yourself down in many ways, but I just can't abide by this. It's too much in your nature to be sharing and be gregarious to let it go to waste or go away out of fear. And I had some friends that went to this hypnotist to stop smoking. And I kind of love things that seem magical. And I liked that it was in Santa Monica, and I kind of had to go, you know, near the ocean to get my brain washed out or whatever. And so I went there, and I went on a Thursday, and I got hypnotized. And whether or not it is real, Saturday I had a show, and it was the best show I had in 2 years. And my stage fright went away.
Were you aware of being hypnotized?
You know, yeah, the whole time I was like, oh, man, this is so expensive. This is so annoying. Not hypnotized. This guy's so weird. I hate his chair. It smells like cats in here, but I can't see a cat. I hate this. This is so annoying. This is so gross. I hate this chair. Why is this chair so gross? I was just like, I do not like this. This is such a scam. And then he was like, and when I count to five, you will be awake. You will be blah, blah, blah. And I was like, oh, my God. And I realized, I don't know how long, but in my head, I had just been walking around in my grandmother's basement, just repetitively, like in my mind with my eyes closed, I'd just been walking around in my grandmother's basement, which was something that I loved because they had like a full bar down there, and they had a bathroom that had wallpaper with like martini glasses and people swimming in the glasses. And I don't know, it's where we had our satyrs, and my grandfather had his trains down there. It was just a nice, I don't know, I picked a nice place that I loved that I was walking around in, and it definitely worked. Yeah, it was real. I went back to try to stop my sleep eating, but I really muscled through that. Didn't work.
Unfortunately, we're out of time. We'll have to save the sleep eating for another edition of Fresh Air. I want to thank you both so much for joining us. And before you both go, Gillian, I just wanted to know, Robespierre, we know that word, I think, from the French Revolution, that name?
Yeah, Maximilian Robespierre was a politician during the Reign of Terror.
Yeah, and, so where do you get your name from?
No one will tell me. No one's confirmed. There's three answers. One is that we are direct descendants. One is that somebody on Ellis Island was very funny and knew a lot about history and played a joke on my ancestors, or my dad changed it on the eve of his bar mitzvah. No confirmation yet on either those being the correct answer.
Are you from a French background?
No, I don't think so. A lot of Russians in my family from the hills of Russia.
Then we could probably scratch the direct descendants idea.
I think so.
Right.
At least your name on Ellis Island wasn't Slotkovich like mine was.
Was it that?
S-L-A-T.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's why it, you know, got shortened to Slate. It was Slotkovich. Slotkovich, I mean, come on.
It's beautiful.
Yeah, it would have been hard in high school. It was already hard in high school.
Would it have been hard on stage? Do you think you would have kept your name or gone with a stage name?
Oh, I don't know. I've never thought of it. Yeah, I'd probably have kept it. I want to keep the stuff about myself that is from my family.
Nice.
I like them.
Yeah, me too.
Well, thank you both so much for talking with us. Jenny Slate, Gillian Robespierre, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Terry.
Jenny Slate stars in the new romantic comedy Obvious Child. Gillian Robespierre wrote and directed the film. There's a funny and very interesting part of the interview in which we discuss how Slate has performed autobiographical material in her stand-up act about discovering sexual urges as a child. But this part was too explicit for broadcast, so we have it as an extra on SoundCloud. That's at soundcloud.com/freshair. Coming up, Ken Tucker reviews Lana Del Rey's new album. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of Lana Del Rey's new album, Ultraviolence, which debuted last week at number one on the Billboard 200 album chart. Del Rey has been a controversial figure, as critics debate the extent of her vocal talent versus her talent for publicity, and she recently caused a stir when she gave an interview in which she said, quote, "I wish I was dead already," and drew criticism from, among others, Kurt Cobain's daughter, Frances Bean. Ken says Del Rey is continuing a time-honored pop tradition of developing a public persona that challenges fans to decide what's real and what's not. Down on the West Coast, they got a saying, if you're not drinking, then you're not playing. But you got the music, you got the music in you, don't you? Down on the West Coast. As an album, Ultraviolence is one long, languid mood piece. If you can't adjust to its wavelength, it's likely to seem ponderous. But let the music work on you, and its slow motion emoting can be thrilling, sometimes funny, sometimes chilling. Collaborating on many cuts here with producer Dan Auerbach of the Black Keys, Lana Del Rey performs with the kind of tremulous intensity that only masquerades as vulnerability. Thank you.
where to start with the provocations within that, the title song of Ultraviolence. For Del Rey to sing in the first verse that she is, quote, filled with poison but blessed with beauty and rage, well, she must be a bratty egomaniac, must she not? To use that title, a phrase cribbed from Anthony Burgess's A Clockwork Orange. To stuff the song with a quotation from the old Jerry Goffin Carol King song, He Hit Me and It Felt Like a Kiss. Oh my, she's not condoning violence, is she? Del Rey, in her late 20s, has a firm grasp on pop history. She makes knowing references to 50s beat poetry and the 70s music of Lou Reed in another song, Brooklyn Baby. And on Money, Power, Glory, she throws all the accusations her critics have leveled against her right back at them.
You say that you wanna go to a land that's far away. How are we supposed to get there with the way that we're living today? You talk lots about God. Freedom comes from the car, but that's not what this bitch wants. Not what I want at all. I want money, power, and glory. I want money and all your power, all your glory.
The music on this album, the instruments and arrangements used, could have appeared during almost any period of rock music since it began. She amusingly referred to her sound as narco swing in a New York Times interview. The singer's frequently multi-tracked vocals sometimes turn her into her own one-person girl group. She knows perfectly well what she's doing when she titles one song Slept My Way Up to the Top, and I changed the first word there to avoid using the real title's four-letter one. Never mind the interviews in which she claims ignorance of or disinterest in feminism, she's faking you out again. In the music and in her videos, Del Rey toys with old notions of attractive young women using charms other than talent to achieve success. By owning these accusations rather than refuting them, she gets to critique not just the critique of her own skills, but also the sexist prejudice that can trail female transgressors in any pop art form.
Share my body and my mind with you. That's all over now. Did what I had to do. 'Cause you're so far past me now. Share my body and my life with you. That's way over now. There's not more I can do. You're so famous now. Got your Bible, got your gun, and you like to party and have fun. And I like my candy.
Lana Del Rey is sharp-witted, aiming to take her place among her predecessors. She is Morrissey with a better pout. She is Katy Perry with the blues. She's the daughter Twin Peaks' Laura Palmer never lived to have. Del Rey dares you to believe that she's all trouble and impure pleasure, even as she crafts music so darkly inviting, it enters you like a knife between your ribs.
Rock critic Ken Tucker reviewed Lana Del Rey's new album, Ultraviolence. Coming up, Maureen Corrigan reviews a new novel about how James Joyce's Ulysses was published and banned. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. The new book called The Most Dangerous Book by Kevin Birmingham is about James Joyce's 1922 novel Ulysses and the censorship battles that surrounded its publication. The novel is set on June 16, 1904, a day the hero of the novel, Leopold Bloom, spends walking all over Dublin. Maureen Corrigan has a review.
There are many heroes in the tale of how James Joyce's masterpiece, Ulysses, which was banned for over 10 years throughout the English-speaking world, finally won its long battle to be legally published, sold, and read. Kevin Birmingham tells that extraordinary story in his new book about Ulysses, called The Most Dangerous Book. As I said, there are many heroes in it, but James Joyce himself isn't one of them. Narcissistic, manipulative, mean, and dissolute, Joyce was a handful from the time he was a teenager. Here's an example. When Joyce was just 20, an intermediary arranged a meeting for him with W.B. Yeats, whom Joyce had publicly criticized as a sentimental sellout. Nonetheless, Yeats was gracious throughout their meeting, even offering to read the younger man's poetry. Joyce eventually stood up to leave and, in a parting shot, asked Yeats how old he was. Yeats said he was 36, and Joyce replied, "We have met too late. You are too old for me to have any effect on you." Arrogant, artsy undergraduates who think their geniuses are a dime a dozen. Joyce, however, was that rarest of creatures, the snot who thinks he's a genius, who really is a genius, and in fact goes on to write a novel that may well be the most important novel ever written in English. Ulysses sparked a revolution because it left nothing out. For the single day it chronicles of Leopold Bloom's wanderings around Dublin, we hear, among a thousand other things, about his daydreams, his erections, his newspaper reading, and the quality of his bowel movements. Ulysses also bombards us with different narrative styles and voices, most famously that of Bloom's wife, Molly, whose words about intercourse from a woman's point of view are now celebrated as one of literature's great soliloquies. Birmingham's book about Ulysses is also expansive. As you'd expect, it chronicles Joyce's decades-long writing process, his private life with his common-law wife, Nora Barnacle, and the extremes of the critical reception Ulysses received. When it was first published in book form in 1922 by Sylvia Beach, the owner of the legendary English-language bookshop in Paris, Shakespeare and Company, the novel was hailed in some reviews as the work of a half-demented man of genius. In the course of reading Ulysses, Virginia Woolf wrote in her diary that she was amused, stimulated, charmed at first, and then puzzled, bored, irritated, and disillusioned as by a queasy undergraduate scratching his pimples. Beyond the standard expectations of literary history, however, Birmingham works in crucial information about, for instance, the role of the U.S. Post Office in enforcing censorship and the grotesque medical treatments Joyce endured for his painful eye inflammations. Birmingham's book is a rich treasury, despite the fact that occasionally he's too clearly pleased with the snaky suppleness of his own sentences and the shock value of his big reveal that Joyce's chronic eye troubles were caused by syphilis. Certainly that diagnosis is a contribution to Joycean biographical scholarship, but I wasn't as surprised by it as I was meant to be. Given the youthful Joyce's loose lifestyle and his poverty, it's amazing he survived at all to write Ulysses, let alone Finnegan's Wake. To me, the more meaningful revelations in The Most Dangerous Book are the subtler ones. For example, Birmingham vividly traces how a network of courageous literary women, the aforementioned Sylvia Beach, as well as Margaret Anderson and Jane Heap, who serialized parts of Ulysses in their magazine The Little Review, risked jail time to help Joyce realize his masterpiece. In a landmark federal obscenity trial in 1933, Ulysses was deemed to be literature by a patrician federal judge named John Woolsey, who was repelled by the gross excesses of Joyce's novel, but also unexpectedly moved by passages like Molly Bloom's soliloquy. Since then, generations of readers have been amazed, inspired, turned off, and turned on by Ulysses. Birmingham helps his own readers see how an enlightened society came to the realization that the only fitting response to a work of art like Ulysses is, to quote Molly Bloom, yes.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed The Most Dangerous Book by Kevin Birmingham. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Molly C.V. Nesper. John Sheehan directed the show. WHYY's chief content officer is Christine Dempsey. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Road Scholar, with educational travel adventures to 150 countries, including Cuba, at roadscholar.org. From Zillow, with homes for sale, historical pricing data, and photos available on Zillow.com or on their mobile apps. Zillow, find your way home. And from Progressive Insurance, with insurance for cars, boats, motorcycles, RVs, and commercial vehicles at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com. This is NPR.
Whoever double-crosses me and leaves me alive, he understands nothing about Tuco. Nothing.
That's Eli Wallach playing Tuco in The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. His career spanned over 60 years. Wallach died Tuesday at the age of 98. On the next Fresh Air, we listen back to our 1990 interview. Join us.